Okay, we are on the record. Would you please state your name for the record?
Linda Super Shears.
Okay, and your birth date, please?
June 11, 1954.
Okay, and which branch of service were you in?
Actually, I was in I was in three branches of service. Okay. I was in the Army. I was in the WACS, actually, from 1974 to 1977.
Okay.
Then I served with the Kentucky National Guard until 1983. And then I had a 20-year break in service, and I re-enlisted on my 50th birthday with the U.S. Army Reserves.
Okay. Excellent. And the highest rank or rate you achieved?
Staff Sergeant.
Okay. And this is taking place in Louisville, Kentucky. My name is Margaret Plattner, Deputy Commissioner for the Kentucky Department of Veterans Affairs. And this interview is being conducted as part of the Library of Congress Veterans History Project. Okay, tell me a little bit about yourself prior to joining the military.
Well, I grew up in Louisville, went to Seneca High School. I think I was a pretty average student, kind of a tomboy. Wanted to do something with my life, wasn't really sure what I wanted to do. Joined the military when I was 19 and decided I wanted to be a medic. And when I went in, I went to Fort Jackson, South Carolina for my basic training. And I was part of the Women's Army Corps at that time.
So it had not, when did the WACS become integrated into the?
I think it was in late 1974 or 75. I remember being part of the changing of the brass at Fort Sam Houston, and that was in late 74. It was about August, and that's where I took my AIT. After
what's your AIT?
I'm sorry. That was your advanced individual training, and that you go to after basic training.
Where'd you do your basic training?
At Fort Jackson, South Carolina.
Okay. And what was that like? Tell me a little bit about that experience.
It was okay. I think I was pretty tough anyway. I think I was ready for it mentally because I knew what was going to happen. Was pretty physically tough already.
Did you come from a military background at all?
No, not at all, but my stepfather was assistant chief of police for Louisville, so I think most of my brothers and sisters will say that, you know, we had a pretty tough regimen at home already, so, you know, I think, you know, going to bed early, a lot of rules and things like that, it wasn't really hard for me to adjust to that.
How did your family take it that you were a woman going into the military?
I think they were
at the time that you did.
Yeah, I think they were 70s. Okay with the idea. At that time, there wasn't a war. It was right after Vietnam, so I don't think anybody was really worried about it. Going into the Army was a way to, I think, get some discipline.
Did you think you needed discipline?
Sure, we all do. You know, in the 70s, we all needed discipline. And there was a lot of protesting going on and things like that. And
So that did not have any effect on you at all with respect to thinking about joining the
military? No, I don't think so. I think I was just didn't really know what to do. And I think when I walked in the recruiter's office, and I actually took the ASVAB, my scores were pretty high. So I could have chosen.
What's the ASVAB?
Oh, the Armed Services Vocational Aptitude Battery.
Okay.
And my scores were pretty high, and I could have chosen several different positions. And nursing was one of the things I was interested in.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you know, they tell you can choose where you want to be stationed after you graduate from your advanced individual training. And I decided to stay in Kentucky to be close enough to home.
So this is after your basic training.
And after my...
And your specialty training,
mm-hmm,
right? And
mm-hmm.
You chose to be a medic. And
yes.
Why did you choose to become a medic versus something else?
Healthcare, because after that, then I could go into nursing. And probably if I decided I didn't like being a medic, then I didn't think I would want to be a nurse. So I was stationed at Fort Campbell, Kentucky, with the 101st, and which was really interesting there.
Why was that interesting?
Well, when we went, there wasn't a lot of females there for the, you know, there actually wasn't a lot of females in the military per se. It was basically a training camp for airborne and air assault missions. So the hospital that I was stationed with was called a MASH hospital, a Mobile Army Support Hospital. And a lot of our mission was to train reserves and National Guard units. They would come down and we would train
medics.
As medics,
mm-hmm.
Yes.
And what's the job of a medic?
Job of a medic is basically in the military, a medic does just about everything that a licensed practical nurse does on the outside. And of course, you would have your training in combat in case you had ever had to go to combat and take care of the wounded. We would practice that. We would go out to the field and set up tents and set up surgical units, operating rooms, you know, just things that you would, I mean, if people watch MASH on TV, that's what we did in the field. We didn't have real patients, but we would have mock patients.
Mm-hmm. So you did a lot of exercise and
yes.
training to prepare
yes.
for the real thing.
Yes, never knowing that I actually would ever be in a real war.
Okay.
But that's what we did. And then...
So you served in Fort Campbell,
mm-hmm.
and how long did you serve there?
I served at Fort Campbell.
Fort Campbell, Kentucky.
Fort Campbell, Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
From probably August of 74 till October 75.
Okay.
And I really...
And after that, what?
I wanted to go somewhere else, so I put in a transfer request to OCONUS, which means overseas. And I went to Germany. Which was West Germany
mm-hmm,
at the time.
Mm-hmm. So where were you stationed?
I was stationed in Nuremberg.
Okay.
And I worked at the U.S. Army Hospital in Nuremberg, Germany.
Now, let me ask you this. Is a medic someone who works in the field, or can the medic also work in the hospital?
Oh, a medic can work in the hospital,
okay,
too.
Okay, so can, it's a...
Yes.
Several different...
Yes. And my...
places a person can
yes,
work.
Several different places. My actual MOS, which... military specialty
mm-hmm.
was a 91 Bravo, which was a medical specialist. So I did not have specialties such as a radiologist or a respiratory therapist or any specialty per se. I was just a general medical specialist.
Okay.
I could help in clinics, I could help on the ward, and I could be like a swing person that could be sent from clinic to clinic to, you know, help out in that sense.
But a medic was equivalent to an LPN?
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Could you give shots?
Oh,
could
yeah.
You?
Yes,
okay.
Yes. We could give shots. We could start IVs. We could do a lot of different things. And the hospital was really a lot better than working at the Fort Campbell.
In what way was it better?
Well, I got to deal with patients. I liked it a lot
directly
better.
Directly. Delivering a service.
Right, and I got to work in pediatrics, which I really liked that.
Mm-hmm. Was that women giving birth and then therefore taking care of children who were born on base, of military members?
Well, our hospital really wasn't on a base, but we were close to a lot of the bases. And we did work with... military personnel, spouses, and we
and
worked
their children.
And their children.
Mm-hmm.
So in pediatrics, I worked with actual child patients, newborn patients, and children that would come in with problems, and asthmatics that had surgery, we would take
mm-hmm.
care of them. And
mm-hmm.
it was, I think it was more rewarding to work with the patients. But then, I started working as a fill-in for other medics that were going on leave, and so I got trained in a lot of different areas. I would
like what would that be?
Radiology to take the place for some of the X-ray technicians that would go on leave, but I wouldn't do any of the major things. I would just do feet and hands and things like that. I substituted in dermatology, just working at the desk, urology, different areas. It was It was a very interesting job.
So when you were stationed in Nuremberg and you were working as a medic, did you ever care for, in addition to families, military families, did you care for any wounded soldiers?
No, we didn't have any wounded soldiers, but I did have to fill in sometimes in the emergency room. And we had soldiers that would get kind of crazy and drink and go driving on the Autobahn. And I did deal with death on occasion, car accidents. There was one incident where we lost two soldiers in the emergency room one night after they were involved in an accident. And that was my first real experience with death. And then when I was working in pediatrics, we had a 9-month-old that died that had a bowel obstruction and with just had an infection, and the baby died then. So that wasn't too pleasant, but I guess that's part of the job.
Yeah. So after Nuremberg, where do you go?
I came home.
To Kentucky.
Mm-hmm. I was discharged in March 1977.
You've done your 4 years.
I did my 3 years.
3 years, okay.
3 years.
Did you just want to get out at that point?
I actually wanted to go to Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
But I would have had to re-enlist for 3 more years because Hawaii was classified as an overseas tour. And you mm-hmm. can't go from one mm-hmm. overseas tour to another overseas tour. So I just decided to come back home.
And what age were you at this point?
Oh, let's see. I was 19 when I went in, so 23.
Okay.
And came back home and decided to go back to school and then
go to college.
Go to college. I went to JCC
mm-hmm.
and Jefferson Community College in Louisville.
Mm-hmm.
But then I got a job with the post office,
mm-hmm.
which is a lot of veterans do that. And started working at the post office and ended up staying with the post office for quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the guys at the post office were in the National Guard, and
mm-hmm.
they talked me into joining the National Guard.
Okay, the Kentucky National
Kentucky
Guard.
National
okay.
Guard.
What year would that have been?
That was in 1978.
Okay.
So I joined the Kentucky mm-hmm. National Guard. And I was in a unit out at the fairgrounds. It was a 104th administration unit
mm-hmm.
out there.
Mm-hmm.
And
what was the overall mission, purpose, and
their mission was an admin mission, okay. administrative mission. But I actually got to stay in my medical position as the medic for the company.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I actually.
So what kind of work did you do?
I taught first aid classes to the soldiers, and
mm-hmm.
And then when we would go to in the National Guard, we used to call it summer camp, but now they call it AT, annual training.
Mm-hmm.
But we would go to different places, and my favorite was going to Camp Shelby, Mississippi, and everybody hated it, but. Because I worked at the post office, I actually would help run the post office for Camp Shelby troops. And me and one of the soldiers that worked with me at the post office, we would run the post office. So that was pretty interesting.
So when you were enlisted in the National Guard, you mm-hmm. were serving 1 weekend a month?
One weekend a month, yes,
okay. and
2 weeks in the summer.
For 2 weeks,
yes.
For active duty
yes.
training.
Okay. And we weren't.
Where did you do your active duty training for 2 weeks?
We went to Camp Shelby, Mississippi,
okay.
quite a bit.
Now, why Camp Shelby, Mississippi?
I think it was set up as a National Guard training center.
Okay.
At that time, there were a lot of places that were still being used for training centers that. They really had no other purpose, I don't think.
Okay. And how long did you serve in the National Guard?
Till 1983.
Okay. And did your job ever change when you served in the National Guard?
No.
Did you have other jobs that you did, or was it primarily focused on what you just talked about?
Primarily focused on training.
Okay.
Yes, and training. And then we changed to a chemical unit because the National Guard is always changing, you know, given different missions. Uh-huh. But my MOS stayed pretty normal. And then I think we changed to a chemical unit, and my MOS became a 71 Lima, which was administrative specialist.
Okay.
Which was okay. You know, I just had to take some classes and get requalified.
Did you enjoy your time in the National Guard?
Oh, yeah, I did.
What made you enjoy it?
Well, my brother came in, too. My younger brother came in, so I had him in there with me. So we could go to AT together.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a camaraderie being in with other soldiers and looking forward to seeing them, you know, once a month. And my mom had some friends that her sorority sister's husband was also in that unit with me, too. So, you know, we had outside friends that were also in the unit. And so it was, and we did other things, and we did community things. We actually was on TV once, Channel 41 in Louisville. We were collecting for the Crusade for Children, and we got to go to Kentucky Derby as security. And so we did other things within the community, too. We didn't just...
So after, okay, once you did your AT, your active duty training, for mm-hmm. 2 weeks, were the time that you served, was the Guard ever federalized and have to serve a mission under extraordinary circumstances like today you have in Iraq and Afghanistan?
No, not while I was there, no.
Okay.
We never had...
Or any weather-like conditions,
no,
disasters,
no.
Emergencies?
No, we weren't, because I think 1974, when we had the tornado
mm-hmm.
here in Louisville, I was in basic training at Fort Jackson. So that's the only thing I can think of that they were activated for during that time period.
Okay. So then why did you get out of the National Guard?
Well, I got married.
Okay.
And my husband was transferred to Chicago. And
he was in the military?
No, he was a civilian, and
okay.
I had a son that was 5 weeks old, so I decided just to get out
mm-hmm.
and be a mom.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a little bit too hard to transfer to Illinois National Guard. I didn't really know anybody that was in the Guard up there, or you know, didn't really have anybody that could possibly watch my son for the 2 weeks in the summer. And you know, I figured I served 10 years, so that was probably enough for me.
Okay. So you moved to Chicago, you get out of the National Guard, and then at some point you re-enlist again. And
yes.
What year was that, and why did you re-enlist?
Well, in 2003, I had been divorced for about 9 years, and my son was in his 20s, and he was actually playing ice hockey, and we all thought that he was going to go to college.
Are you back in Kentucky, by the way?
I'm actually back in Chicago.
Okay.
And still in Chicago. And thought he was going to go to college and play hockey, and I decided to move back to Kentucky. The winters in Chicago are pretty rough, and I wanted to come back home. And so I got a position with the VA hospital. And I did have...
On Zorn Avenue?
Zorn Avenue, okay. Yes. I worked for the government also while I was in Chicago. I worked for the Office of Personnel Management for about 5 years. And I did work for... my job was to... I was in charge of the test administrators that gave the ASVAB test, and I worked with the Department of Defense very closely, and so I got a taste of the military again. And during that time, Desert Storm took place, and September 11th took place, and so I was, you know, aching to get back involved with the military. Never lost my desire to serve my country. And at one point in 1991, I was going to go back in the reserves, and but my son was only 8 years old, and mm-hmm. I decided not to do that. Mm-hmm. He was too young. But in 2003, I decided to move back to Kentucky, and I started working at the VA hospital in 2004, and started working with the returning veterans from OEF, the Operation Enduring Freedom.
Iraq. Okay.
And we, I don't know, I just felt like that I wasn't really doing enough, and I wanted to try to go back in and do something. I was in pretty good physical shape. I was divorced. My son was, I thought, old enough to pretty much take care of himself. He's still in Chicago. He mm-hmm. lived with his dad. Mm-hmm. And didn't have a whole lot of time to decide to do it, because I had to do it by my birthday, because you had to have enough time left to be, you had to have served 20 years by your 60th birthday in order to re-enlist. And that meant I had to re-enlist by my birthday, June 11th, 2004, to be able to get in. I started talking to a recruiter in January of 2004, but then decided, nah, I really don't want to do it. I'm going to be 50. This is nuts. And but then I talked to my son about it, and I talked to other people about it, and I thought, you know, if I'm going to do this, I need to do it. So thought about it for a while, and then in the end of May, talked to the recruiter again, and he goes, I don't think we have enough time to get you in. And I said, well, you don't know me too well. I'm determined. So we had it all settled, and then President Reagan died that week, and all the federal offices were going to be closed, and that week I had to get reenlisted. So on Thursday, June the 10th, some paperwork had to be approved by battalion, some waivers, and because I had lived in Chicago, I had to get, you know, you have to get the police records, any speeding tickets, anything had to be signed and cleared before you could reenlist. And it was 5:30 on Thursday afternoon, and they said, well, we can't do it. And then I got a phone call from my recruiter, and he says, where are you? And I said, I'm sitting in the parking lot of the federal building crying. He says, why? And I go, because I can't do it. But then the National Guard said they would take me if I couldn't go in the reserves, because they could still take me. And he said, well, don't cry. He said, battalion just approved it. You're going to be reenlisted in the morning. We've called in a major from the Marines. He's going to come in, because there wasn't going to be anybody in the federal building the day they buried Ronald Reagan, which was June 11th. So the next morning I showed up, and this major goes, well, you're going to remember today for a special reason, aren't you? And I go, you know it's my birthday? And he says, no, we're burying our president. And he said, it's your birthday? And I went, yeah. And he goes, well, how old are you? And I said, 50. And he goes, are you nuts? I said, no. But then when I told my mom, she asked me the same question.
So you re-enlist, and what'd you re-enlist as? What was your grade at this point?
I re-enlisted as an E4.
Okay.
I came out of the Army as an E4.
Okay.
And I re-enlisted as an E4.
No,
I'm sorry, as an E5.
Okay.
They actually gave me my rank, which is very unusual that they do that, but that was also one of the conditions to re-enlist. And I wanted to go back.
Did you get to keep your same MOS?
No. Well, yes and no. They gave me my 91 Bravo back.
Which is your medic.
Because I was a medic. But 68 Whiskey actually was the new MOS for combat, and it was combat medic now. And because there was a war going on, I would have had to gone back to San Antonio and gone through a lot more training. And I said, okay, that's not a problem. And then...
So you went back in as a combat medic.
I actually didn't get the opportunity to do the training, because I went back in and I was signed up to go to the school in September of 05, but in June of 05 I got deployed. And they deployed me to Iraq.
Were you activated at
yes,
this point?
Yes, I was activated.
Did you expect this was going to happen?
Yeah, I did.
And you were okay with
it? I was okay with it. Because they called me and said, we had bad news and good news. And I go, well, give me the bad news. Well, you're deployed to Iraq. And I said, well, what's the good news? They said, well, you're going as a postal supervisor. And I thought, well, okay, I have 7 years with the post office. So they deployed me on my secondary MOS, which was administrative. And mm-hmm. and that number had changed from a 17 Lima to a 42 Alpha. Okay.
So you're deployed to Iraq. How long did you serve in Iraq?
Well, we served at Fort McCoy for 5 months to go through the pre-deployment training,
which was where?
In McCoy, Fort McCoy, Wisconsin.
Are you trained? What were you trained for?
To be a postal supervisor. Okay. And we went through a lot of intense combat training.
Okay.
Live fire training, weapons.
How'd you feel about that?
Okay.
Okay.
I'd already, in basic training, we went through weapons training. Okay. The part that was hard was getting used to wearing the ballistic part of it, the vest, the helmets. And why in the world would they send us to Wisconsin where it was so cold and snowing? But it was a dehydration. You know, you dehydrate in the winter just as well as you do in the summer. But we had to do convoy training, rollover training, Humvee training, night vision training, medevac training. And all of us, I'm proud to say, 100% of our company did combat lifesaver training. And that's the reason that there's so many soldiers making it home today, because each one of us was trained how to save a life in the combat arena, apply tourniquets, give IVs, what to do.
So you felt like your training was sufficient?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
And I really commended the guys back at Fort McCoy. I was able to bring home all my soldiers with no injuries. Just me, my commander, were injured. But they all came home safe.
Okay, so you go over and you're a postal supervisor.
Yes.
And tell me about that experience.
And
where are you located in Iraq?
We're in Forward Operating Base Falcon.
Okay,
which
where was that located?
It's within the city of Baghdad, okay. But down in the south western suburbs of Baghdad.
Okay.
So Baghdad is as big as Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be like in the southwest suburbs of Chicago,
mm-hmm.
about 22 miles south of the main city, south of the green zone, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And
were you in a dangerous area?
Very dangerous area.
Was your protection good?
Well, we were protected by, we were supported by the 101st and the 4th ID out of Fort Hood, Texas, and we had about 5,000 troops on the base with us. We had aerial support from all over. But, when the insurgents want to drop mortars on you, they do, no matter how you...
Were you a Shiite area of town, section of town, or a Sunni section?
We were
of town?
In between.
Okay.
Yeah, we were like right in the middle of the Anbar province in Al-Sadura. I don't know if you've heard of the Al-Dora area, was pretty much the neighborhood where we were located. And it was I know it's kind of gross, but it's like was the dumping ground for body parts. And soldiers there would go out, and it was a lot of mortars went off in our area. A lot of IEDs, the unidentified explosives would
did
be buried.
Did you go off base?
Yes.
And did you have protection when you went off base? And why would you go off base?
Well, the post office is not always handy for soldiers, and I don't. It's no matter where you are, from the days of the Civil War on up, the men need men. I say men in general, but I mean the military need the post office. They need to hear from home because it's mm-hmm. part of the morale. Mm-hmm. And we would get the mail in to be, separated and sent out to the post office. And then the Black Hawk helicopters would drop mail off to the outlying areas. But in order for their letters, the soldiers' letters, to get home to their families, they were not always able to get into the post office. And the Black Hawk helicopters did not pick up mail. So it was our job to go out and take the post office on the road. So we would take it to them.
So tell me what kind of protection you had. Were you in a convoy at this
yes,
point?
Okay. Yes, yes. When we got there, we started sending our soldiers, which was my job as their supervisor, to set up convoys. And I would contact the first of the 502nd out of Fort Campbell, or the second of the 506 out of, they're like the Band of Brothers out of Fort Campbell, to set up a security to take my three soldiers to what's called the Mamadiya, Lutafia, and Yusufia, and it's also the Triangle of Death. If anybody's familiar with that area, it was very, very dangerous. They called it IED Alley, and one of his name is, Al-Zakari was very heavy into mm-hmm. Fighting. That's where his home base was. So it was my job to send my soldiers out. And at first, we would send them out on convoys. And then I worked with the flight units up in Baghdad to work it out to where maybe I could fly them down and start them at Mamadiya, and then they could convoy down to the other two FIAs, which worked out better for safety. And I think that was one of the accomplishments that we were able to do when we were there. And it worked out better, and it was safer, and it was less IEDs.
Okay.
So my commander and I were able to do that.
Well, how far were you when you originally went out? How far would you have to go out to deliver them?
About 30 to 40 miles circumference.
So then you worked it out where they could fly to a certain point and uh-huh. over and get past the real danger zone and then deliver the mail from a different routing area?
They were still in danger, but uh-huh. They weren't targets for that one long, straight road. MSR Tampa was very dangerous.
Okay.
And it worked out better. And then that convoy could drop them at Mamadiya, and we'd meet up with the first of the 502nd, and then they knew that area better than the other guys. And
so delivering the mail was a hazardous job. Well, you could lose your life. That's
yeah, we actually didn't deliver. We would go out and pick up.
Okay, but picking up the mail.
Yeah, absolutely.
You could lose your life picking up the mail.
Oh, yeah, but I mean, that was our mission. So,
well, you mentioned being injured. What happened?
Mm-hmm. Well, the first, I decided that I needed to go do the mission, too, because I was sending my guys out, and my females went out, too. So
you had men and women working for you.
Yes, and I was going to go on a mission because I hadn't left the FOB. And, of course, my commander goes, well, you don't need to go. And I go, well, I need to go where they go because it's not right for me to send them and not go. And being the person I am, I'm going to go anyway. So I set up a mission to go in September, and we were getting new command down in the FIAs.
September what year?
Oh, 06.
Okay.
Actually, it was September 10th. And everybody's going, you know, you don't really want to go now, do you? And I go, well, if anybody's going now, it's going to be me. So we actually left on September 9th, and we're going to come back on the 11th.
How many people did you go with?
I went with, I was me and then two people from a finance unit, National Guard unit in New York. And
were you in a convoy truck? Or?
No, we okay. flew okay. in a Black Hawk.
Okay.
We flew in a Black Hawk, and the Black Hawks took us to Mamadia, south of, you know.
Was there any danger in transporting you in a Black Hawk?
Oh, sure.
Okay.
Sure, because they would come in totally black. I mean, no lights, nothing. And we would get on. And
this is at night?
At night, mm-hmm. always at night. And then fly total black to Mamadia, get off at Mamadia. And, of course, the first time that you get on a Black Hawk, and it's funny, but it's not funny, there would be people on the ground with their night vision goggles. Of course, they had everything we did, the insurgents. They would shoot rocket-propelled grenades, which are RPGs, at us. And in order to blind them on the ground, the helicopter pilots would shoot flares. So the first time they would shoot flares, you would just totally freak out because you didn't know what was going on.
Did they tell you that in advance?
No, okay. They don't tell you. Okay. They just do it.
Okay.
And the first time they did it, which was long before my first mission to the Triangle, was going to Baghdad once on a flight. I had to fly to Baghdad maybe once every week to get change for my post office. So I flew a lot of missions. And first time it happened, I was like jumped and so scared. And of course, the others on the flight that were already there, it's okay, it's just flares. But one mission, it wasn't a flare, it was an RPG coming towards us, and it just missed us by about 6 inches. And then they shot flares. And then one mission I was on, we actually got shot at, and they dented up the door, and we got off. And one of the flight crew chiefs said, "Hey, look, we got hit." And I went, "Oh, wonderful." But that's why we never flew with the doors open, even though it was so hot. But anyway, September 9th, we were took off to Mamadia. We were in Mamadia, and we got a convoy to go to a place called the JSB Bridge to do our first, switch over with the mail. And it was used to be a water processing plant on the Euphrates River. And we ended up staying there overnight because they did a sweep of the road, and there were 8 IEDs and several IEDs had gone off. And then the Iraqi army did a sweep of the road, and they found more IEDs. So they didn't feel it was safe for us to go on the road. And so we had to spend the night there. And that was kind of interesting because a couple of the nationals brought a couple of kids on the FOB. It was a very small FOB with just a couple of units. Some kids on the base that had liver disease and from the water. And so we gave them shots. And they allowed me to help them because I'm a mom and I hadn't seen a little kid in so long, and so I helped give them shots and talk to the father through an interpreter to tell him what to do to help her stay healthy and give them shots mm-hmm. and stuff. So, you know, we help them. We were helping them at the same time that, you know, they were being killed by their own people. But anyway, we went out the next morning. They finally said, okay,
they being
the commanders of the guys that were taking us out on the convoys, and they said, well, the Iraqi army cleared it so we can go. But the only bad thing about that is we weren't really that trusting of the Iraqi army clearing the route.
Is it because you were suspicious of their truthfulness or suspicious based on their competency?
Their competency, the way they would clear a route, they would go 90 miles an hour and go, yeah, it's okay. And I think they were just as scared of getting blown up as we were. So we got out, and within like 4 kilometers of where we were, an IED went off in front of our Humvee. And we were lucky because it went off right in front of us.
Now you're in the Humvee at
yes.
this point.
Okay. Uh-huh. And it went off right in front of us. And, of course, we had to call it back. And nobody was hurt. And we called back, nobody's hurt. And we kept going, and we just went faster. Because usually there's more than one. There, sometimes you can call them a daisy chain. If one goes off, there might be another one right behind it, so we don't want to wait around.
Mm-hmm.
And then we got to the next FOB, I think it was.
And what's FOB stand for?
Forward Operating Base.
Okay.
And there's smaller FOBs down there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was Lutafia. And we got there, and I had to call my commander. And, of course, he goes, "You're never leaving the FOB again." And I said, "Oh, okay." And we did.
But you weren't injured, but you mentioned at some point you had been injured.
When I got back after coming back, I had lost some hearing
okay.
in my left ear
okay.
from that explosion.
Mm-hmm.
So now I have tinnitus in my left ear. It rings. Just weird times. It'll just start ringing. We went to Lutafia, and which was the small FOB, and we had to spend the night there that night. And then and spending the night there was very interesting too, because they had had a huge fire a couple of months before that and had lost just everything. The guys that lived there lost a lot of their personal items and stuff. And I remember all of my guys getting things, and we were packing up boxes, and I called my American Legion back here in Louisville, Legion 201, Highland Post, getting clothes and stuff and sending boxes down to the guys because they had lost clothes and everything.
And why did they lose all this?
There was a fire.
Oh, a fire.
A fire, okay. Yeah. And then we had to sleep in this huge tent, and there was me and one other female. And there were no other females there.
Were there very few women that you were serving with? Or
yeah,
were there?
Yes. There. Well,
okay.
I had 8 females with me, but there were very few women. But there were women there serving, and really just they're combat positions,
mm-hmm.
Not combat MOSs, but support positions.
Mm-hmm.
And but it was kind of funny because Sergeant Neal and I. We go into this tent, and it's all men, but you know what? We're all so exhausted, we just found a cot and went
mm-hmm.
to sleep, and we didn't care.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, we just didn't care. It was, you know, you're safe.
Yeah. What, how long did you serve in Iraq?
Almost a year. It was 11 months, 3 weeks, and some 4 days or something
and
like that.
And how would you characterize your time that you served in Iraq?
It was very rewarding for me.
In what way?
Just be there with those soldiers and do what we did. And I think we did a lot of good. The guys that went out, they built cities. They helped build schools. The civil engineers that I served with, they went out and helped people. The medics I served with, they treated Iraqis, they, you know, did a lot of things to help, and it was just, in a way it was bad too, because, you know, it seemed like the more we built things, the more the insurgents were determined to tear it down.
Mm-hmm.
But our last couple of months there were bad, because, I also got hurt in October, kind of, it was a bad injury. And
how did you get hurt?
I don't mind talking about it. We never had any entertainment because we were considered hot. And that hot means the mortars came in on a regular basis. It was a constant. Is it an outgoing mortar? Is it an incoming? When you first get there, you don't know the difference. But when you're there for a couple of weeks, you learn the sound. Like outgoing mortars sound like Roman candles, the 4th of July. And incoming mortars, they're just different. They hit different. they land different, and you just get this feeling of, oh man, where did they land?
Mm-hmm.
And you didn't know where they landed. They land by the PX, they may land at the fuel site, or they may land right next door to you, or in the shower, or, you know. So we were constantly at the post office getting hit with mortars, and if we had customers at the post office, we'd have to get them out and get them in bunkers. And it was 24/7. My guys may be out on the flight deck at 3 in the morning waiting for the Chinook helicopters to bring in the mail, because we were using mail trucks, but the mail trucks were getting hit on the routes. So we were losing more mail that way. So then they decided to bring...
So how did you get injured?
We got lucky one night, and we had a bunch of comedians come in. It was awesome. It was so awesome. They were coming in, and we're thinking, okay, our softball got canceled. We got mortared the night we played a softball game. You know, everything else we did got canceled. So these comedians were...
Because of the mortars.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the comedians were so brave, so we're going, I don't even care. We're going to watch. And so my commander and I and a couple of our soldiers went to watch the comedians at the dining facility. And so when it was over, we hung around a little bit longer because we were so starved for entertainment. We talked to everybody. But a couple of them, one was from Tennessee, two were from Kentucky. And, you know, we were taking pictures and joking around with them. So when we left, my commander went to the right, back to where his barracks were. And I went to the left to where my barracks were. And then a mortar came in, and it was over to where he was going. And we had Iraqi cell phones, which when I had an Iraqi cell phone, I just thought that was just too wild anyway. But anyway, that's the only way we could keep in contact with our soldiers. And we only had 18, so it was okay. We didn't need the radios. We had the cell phones. And so he calls me, and he's screaming, I'm hit, I'm hit, I'm hit. I'm going, oh, my God. And he goes, no, it's okay. It's just in my leg. I'm bleeding, but I'm going to the TMC, the Troop Medical Clinic. I go, all right. He goes, where are you? And I said, well, I'm going to my barracks. He goes, well, all right, all right. And then the second mortar came in, and it was closer to the dining facility. So I knew that they were walking them in. And what walking them in means, they knew where they were trying to hit the dining facility, because that's where everybody was watching the comedy show. So we knew we had spies on base. They were having a comedy show, so send them in like this way. So the third one came in, and it hit a truck like maybe about 80 meters from me, and I thought there was a driver in it, so I started to go over to the truck. And then the fourth one hit, and it hit way too close to where I was, so I ran in a bunker.
How far was it from you?
It was about 100 meters.
Okay.
And I ran to the bunker, and then all of a sudden things started exploding, and I wasn't really sure if another mortar hit a truck that exploded, because we had gas trucks and, you know, parked mm-hmm. where I was mm-hmm. headed mm-hmm. in front of on the road. And then all of a sudden things just started exploding, and people are running, and it reminded me of the invasion of Hanoi, and people, you remember the Vietnamese running, and people were running without shoes and shirts and shorts, and they were just running and running and running. And they were all Indians and Pakistanis and people that worked on our FOB, for our kitchen and our laundry facilities, and they were just running and running and running. And I was trying to get them to come into the bunker with me, but they wouldn't. They just kept running. And one guy drove up and parked his car right by the bunker, and I tried to get him to come in, and he was just, you know,
safe in your barracks?
My barracks were too far to get to.
From the mortar to hit?
Yes.
Okay.
And, the mortar, it was safer for me to stay where I was, because stuff was flying through the air.
Mm-hmm.
So I figured it out. The mortar had hit the ammo holding area, and I was only about 100 meters from the center of the blast. And what was flying in the air was the ammo that we stored. It was hit, and so the stuff was flying.
Did you get hit or anything?
By percussion. I was in the bunker, and the bunker was getting hit. Stuff was flying in the air. A big piece of, I think it was a piece of a Connex, which was, you know, a Connex is what the trains pull,
okay.
The big containers mm-hmm. that you store stuff
mm-hmm.
in.
Mm-hmm.
Hit my feet. They were bruised. I lost my toenails several times. But stuff was hitting on top of the Connex, and stuff was flying and flying. I was trying to find out where my soldiers were. I had two up at Baghdad. They were safe. I had three over in what was called the T building, and they were in a hardened area. I told them to stay where they were. My platoon sergeant was calling me. I said, I'm in a bunker. I'm safe. My other soldiers were in their barracks. They were safe, we thought, and they were in the 200 buildings, which were concrete. I said, stay where you are. And then I had two of my gun hold soldiers were, where are you? I'm in the bunker in front of the ice maker. We're coming to get you. No, you're not. Because if you come get me, you're going to hit by flying a projectile, and you're going to bleed out, and you're going to die. So I'm okay. Stay where you are. And no. And I said, that's direct order. You know, you have to do it. That's direct order. You stay. You know. All right, Sergeant B. You know, once I do that, they know I'm serious.
Mm-hmm.
So I stayed there. I was there for almost three and a half hours by myself. And the percussion, explosions, percussion. I'd look out.
Were you scared unbelievably?
Yeah.
Did you think you were going to die?
Many times. I also had a friend that was in the green zone that was an ammo specialist. I called him. I go, you know where? He goes, what the hell is going on? Uh-oh. Sorry.
That's okay. You can say whatever you want to say.
What the hell is going on down there? He said, we're all on alert in the green zone. He said, they've called out. He said, are you guys getting bombed still? I go, no, it's the ammo. So they're up at the biop, which is the Hussein's, the Baghdad International Airport. They're up on a filming it from there at 22 miles away. I called my mom and told her to...
On an Iraqi cell phone?
Yeah.
Okay.
Inside the bunker, and said, turn the TV on. We're getting bombed, but I'm okay. I'm inside the bunker. And this is where it all got crazy, because having an Iraqi phone was like having the old Verizon commercial. Can you hear me now? Can you hear me now? And in the bunker, during the explosions, for 3 hours, I talked to everybody. I talked to all of my soldiers. I talked to my soldiers up in Baghdad. I talked to my friends in the green zone. I called my mom. I called everybody. And I know I only had 20 minutes left on my phone, because you have to call in.
Were you calling everyone? What was the reason you were calling everyone? To let them know you were safe, or because you feared for
your
life?
I didn't know what was going to happen.
Okay.
And I figured I better talk to everybody now. And, yeah, fight or flight.
So when all the mortars and the projectiles and all of that finally ceased?
It didn't.
Okay. in that particular event?
Well, it,
at some point it came to a conclusion.
Yeah,
didn't
the
it?
Next morning.
Okay, and you stayed there until the next
morning? No, I stayed there for 3 hours.
Okay.
And then...
What made you decide to leave?
Well, the fire, the gases came. And then I was choking. I didn't have a gas mask because there was no threat of gas for us, they figured. So we didn't have to carry our gas mask around with us. But we did have to wear our helmets. We were at U3, which is uniform 3, level 3, which was helmets. You had to carry your weapon all the time. But your Kevlar vest, which, you know, heavy, oof.
So you have a weapon with you, you have your vest on.
And my helmet.
And your helmet.
And my helmet. But I did get out of the bunker at one time because I felt I was suffocating in there. I was just, now I'm claustrophobic more than I ever have been from being in the bunker, I think. So I got
out. How big is the bunker?
Oh, maybe as wide as the chalkboard, 6 feet wide,
okay.
Maybe 5 feet tall,
okay.
And the open-ended. It was one of those that they didn't close off.
Were you completely sealed off when you were in the bunker?
No.
Or did you have some idea what was going on the outside?
Oh, I knew what was going on.
Would you peek up and look, or how did you?
Well, I was covered.
Okay, right.
But I could look out.
Okay.
Of either side. And I would look out because...
There was that mechanism in place where you could look out?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I could look out. And I looked out because I was smart enough to realize that when it flashed, to get back in.
Mm-hmm.
Because you had like 3 seconds before
mm-hmm.
the percussion.
Mm-hmm.
But a couple of times, I didn't get back in. The percussion hit me. And once I went out and the percussion hit me, and I went to the back of the bunker where I was still safe because the bombs were on this side, but my back was here, but I couldn't breathe because the gases were going in the bunker. And the reason I had to get out of there was because the fire, like, you figure the open end of bunker is here, and there's 3 or 4 trucks, fuel trucks here. The fire was going towards the fuel trucks, and the fuel trucks are parked this way. And if they hit the fuel trucks, I'm in the bunker.
So you knew you had to get out of there.
I was going to be killed because it would have been...
So you knew you had to get out of there.
Yeah,
so you get out, and what do?
I ran up in a ditch and stayed in there for a little while to make sure. Then I ran up the ditch, and then I ran over towards the dining facility. And there was a kid in there scared to death, and he was in a bunker. They had left him on guard. And I go, "You need to get out of here." He goes, "Well, I was told to stay." And I go, "Well, okay, General, rule one, you know, stay until you're, you know, replaced." So it quietened down quite a bit, and I didn't see any more projectiles. But now that I look back at it, it was really stupid of me to run to the troop medical clinic because there was projectiles all over the base.
But if you had stayed, you might have risked being burned, right?
Right. But running, I could have risked stepping on a hand grenade.
So either way, it was a huge risk.
Yeah. So I got to the troop medical clinic. My face was bleeding. They fixed up my face, looked at my eyes. They could tell I was dizzy and shaken up. And, "Where were you?" I told them where I was. "Are you okay?" "I don't know." "Sit here for a while." So I stayed there till about 4 or 5 in the morning. Then I went back to the post office, and I stayed there for the next 3 days because we had no movement on the FOB because nobody could move because of everything on the post. So we had to just drink water and eat the meals, the Army meals.
MREs.
Right. I couldn't think of it.
That's okay.
The MREs. And we had MREs everywhere, so people got MREs. And
tasted?
Yeah, not bad. I mean, they're
what
better.
What did you eat, for example? What did you have?
Oh, I liked the chicken, peanut butter. It didn't matter. I was hungry.
Mm-hmm.
But every time I ate, I threw it up because I had a concussion and couldn't sleep. My head was killing me. So finally, I was thrown up so much that they took me back to the TMC, and they gave me an IV. I stayed over there all day one day, and then got in a Humvee because General Thurman came down and checked out the base, and we had 5 EOD teams, ordnance teams,
mm-hmm.
naval ordnance teams came and tried to clean up what we had and stuff they could touch, they got rid of. And
this has happened a couple of months before you left?
This was in October
okay.
10th, and we left in December.
So obviously a jarring experience.
Very.
Very jarring.
Traumatic.
Did you suffer any post-traumatic stress from this experience?
Yeah, still.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
A lot. And my docs there were awesome. They were from Fort Hood and BAMC and Walter Reed.
What does an experience like that do to a person? What does it do to you?
Changes you for life.
In what way?
Well, the brain injury itself changes you because...
So you suffered TBI, traumatic brain injury?
I have a moderate traumatic brain injury to the left superior cerebellum.
Okay.
And I'm what my doctor at Walter Reed calls a black swan. He's published a paper about my injury, and I saw him.
What is a black swan?
You only see one, maybe in a lifetime. And according to him, they've seen one. They haven't seen another one like mine. Because most people that suffer traumatic brain injuries get them from maybe one explosion, or they get an IED on this mission, you know, and they get an injury, and then they go out maybe another mission and they get hit again, and they may have another injury. But my injury was caused by multiple blasts over a 3-hour period. So it's, and I made him, so I saw him last week in Kansas City at the Military Medical Forum, and I was invited to go to that. And I asked him to tell me in layman's term, you know, don't talk to me mm-hmm. like I'm a Mensa member. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I said, he said, it's like seeing a black swan. We saw yours and we haven't seen another one. So it's sitting like on the hypothalamus and right there on the top of the stem, but I have short-term memory problems.
Okay, so that's the consequences of what you've experienced.
Yeah, and I can't learn new things. I have great long-term memory. I can play Jeopardy every night. You know, we do that, my family, and it's great, but like your name, I read it on a piece of paper and 10 seconds later I couldn't think of
Jeez,
it.
Jeez, I do that all the time.
I know, we all do, but it's like, it's constant with me. Mm-hmm. And I have to put things in the same place, because if I don't put my keys in the blue, you know, bowl by my door and I put them on the table, it still doesn't matter
so
if they're not there.
It's affected your short-term memory. That's what I'm hearing you say.
Quite a bit. And okay. I have vestibular problems. I have balance issues. I've had I go to occupational therapy still. I go to physical therapy.
Do you feel like the medical care you're receiving is of a quality nature?
I think. I don't know how to answer that. I think when they listen to me, and I feel like that I know more about my injury than my docs do, only because we don't know as much about TBIs as we need to know. And we certainly don't know about TBIs as opposed to post-traumatic stress. I think we have a lot of soldiers, not just soldiers, but a lot of military that are being misdiagnosed. I know it's being worked on. I mean, I've talked to a lot of people in the military field. I've talked to a lot of people in Congress.
How are they being misdiagnosed?
Well,
what are they being diagnosed with? And when actually, in all actuality, you think it's a misdiagnosis?
Personality disorders.
Okay.
I think we've had a lot of military that's been discharged. Wrongly with personality disorders.
In other
disorders.
Words, you think it's more related to TBI
Absolutely.
Or PTSD?
Absolutely.
Okay. You think it's a convenient way for the military
Absolutely.
To discharge someone?
Yeah.
Okay.
Rather than
caring for the person?
Well, I don't think we've been prepared to care for them. I think we're just now getting the TBI clinics that we need. I think the Defense and Veterans Brain Injury Clinic at Walter Reed was like the first place that actually, and that's where I went, and I still get called by them, and I'm on like a 15-year study. They're gonna call me for 15 years. And I just think there's a lot of people that I've actually talked to that they're not sure what's wrong with them.
How do you differentiate in your experience the TBI versus the PTSD? Because you said you've been diagnosed with both.
Both, okay. Yes. And, I can just be just fine, and all of a sudden some little thing, like I ran over a squirrel,
mm-hmm.
and it just tore me up,
mm-hmm.
you know. I mean, that might be a trigger for me for PTSD. But
But have you received any therapy for PTSD?
I am. I'm getting therapy for both. Okay. And I had such great docs over in Iraq that they knew enough about traumatic brain injury that they thought I might have suffered it. But because our base was on a blackout, we didn't have power or anything. But they treated me as if I had a concussion. And then when I got back, I had a great counselor. And we actually had a pediatric neurologist that was head of case managers at Fort McCoy for our post-deployment people that called Walter Reed and talked to them and said, I have somebody that needs to come up there. And I was lucky. I was so lucky. It was like I was in the right place at the right time.
Are you, in bringing this to a close, fascinating to hear about this. And I wish you a healthy and speedy recovery, although maybe this will be a long-term.
Well, it's a lot better than it was. And I do keep up with it, and I do help out with the Brain Injury Alliance, and I go and I speak with reserve units and yellow ribbons and try to help identify.
Are you still in the Army Reserves?
No. Okay. I was medically discharged on October 31st, 2008.
Was that hard for you?
Very hard to give up that part of my life.
Yeah. So the military has meant a lot to you. In a nutshell, in what sense?
The camaraderie and the belonging, and I'm sure you know how that is. Yeah, it's just, I don't think there's a society or a group, a club you can belong to that is like it, you know, being a veteran.
So you're proud of the service that
absolutely.
Let me ask you this. Did you, as a woman, and particularly when you went into the 1970s, did you feel like you experienced any discrimination or much discrimination at all during your time of service?
Maybe a little bit. But it's all changed.
Has it changed for the best since you went in the 70s and then you went back in 2005? Has life in the military changed for women?
Yeah.
And treatment in the military? And in
treatment,
what way?
Treatment in a way. I mean, you still get your, you know, there's still sexual trauma. There's still a lot of sexual assault, but I think that is not as bad as it used to be. But I think for the most part, there are a lot of jobs that are opened up to females that were never opened up to me. I have a really good friend. I actually call her my niece. She's not my niece, but I basically adopted her in Iraq, and she was a gunner in an MP unit in Iraq, and she favored my niece so much that we got to be close, and she came over to Kentucky and spent 8 days with me and my family. And she's reminds me of me when I was in the 70s. I wanted to go airborne. Oh, no, you can't. You know, well, how about air assault? No. So I said, well, what can I do? So they allowed me to do, I was the first female at Fort Campbell to graduate from the Air Transportability School, where I went in and I learned how to do load tables and such for deployments, if we ever had to deploy units. And I got a big citation from the commanding general of
That's
the base
great.
And my picture in the paper and stuff. But and I always was challenging that stereotype that women couldn't do stuff. And I was on the pistol team and fired expert rifle, pistol, grenade. So I did what I could do within the barriers, but it is much better than it was. But it still can change. But I think the Iraq conflict and Afghan conflict has shown to everyone that women can do a lot more. I mean, look at Tammy Duckworthy, and she's still in the Army, you know, Army National Guard.
And she was a helicopter pilot.
Oh, yeah.
Lost both of her legs.
Both legs and an arm.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, wow, I wish they'd let me stay in, but, you know, it's okay. I can still do other stuff. But
well, I want to thank you for sharing your story today, a moving story, particularly about Iraq. And so I want to thank you for your time.
You're welcome.
Thank you for your service.
You're welcome.
To
thank
our
you.
Country, and thank you for your dedication. Obviously, the military has meant a lot to you, I
mm-hmm.
can tell. So thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Okay. Also, this concludes the interview of... did you get out as an E5? Is this
E6.
E6, Staff
Sergeant.
This concludes the interview with Staff Sergeant Linda Brashears.